Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 24th, 1998. In the Fireside Building this evening, Erling Gerstad. His session number is 98-1. It's titled Faith and Medicine, New Directions. Let's listen in.
And then tomorrow I want to take a sort of a long historical viewpoint on healing in the Hebrew Bible and healing in the New Testament, and then whatever happened to healing after the end of the apostolic age. And then on Wednesday, I want to look at some specific alternative medicine practices, especially visualization and meditation, and look at that, and then also look at sort of the Asian roots of this, because as I'll be talking about, this is a very interesting sort of thing. And on Thursday, we're going to have a case study. We're not going to do therapeutic touch, but we're going to talk about it. This is just for fun. Does that ring a bell, therapeutic touch, with some people here want to? Usually nurses. No, you're not a nurse, but a lot of people, right? And this very controversial.
I live in Berkeley, so.
You live in Berkeley? I had a semester at Berkeley, so at the GTU. Right? So then also something on the critics of complementary alternative medicine. And then on Friday and on Saturday, a big word, the medicalization of society. That is how, in many respects, the world of medicine, be it alternative or be it orthodox medicine, is replacing religious teachings and religious practices. It's a very controversial sort of thing, and I think that we should have a lot of fun with that. And I'll say this, if many of you won't be here, but that's Saturday at 6:20, and that's among the faculty sort of considered the graveyard shift with this. But I remember last year, or was it the year before? I can't remember. We only had 5 people here. And honest to goodness, that's the best discussion I've ever had. I saw everybody has to take their turn on Saturday at 6:20. But I will take Saturday at 6:20 anytime if I get a discussion going like that. Everybody just sort of opened up and talked and very relaxed, and we had a grand time doing it. Okay, so we have to start with definitions here. And I don't want to spend too much time on definitions, because you can get lost in definitions. And my son said he went through law school, the only thing he learned was to avoid spending time on definitions, because lawyers like nothing more than spending time, and we don't have to mention who's been worrying about legal definitions in the last week or so over this sort of thing. Just one story on that. When I was in graduate school, the first topic was discussion of John Fiske's book, The Critical Period in American History. And this was graduate school, that's big time stuff. And we spent the whole 90 minutes discussing the word "the." What did that mean? We didn't get on the critical period in American history. But everybody went away thinking that was a pretty swell discussion if we only got to the first word, the critical period instead of a critical period, and that had horrendous implications, for some people there. Being a badger at that time, I just went off to Paris, place and had a beer and let it go. Definitions are very important, and I want to start with how I got interested in this, and some of you from last year may have heard these stories, but I think for the story I told, it may be worth repeating again. I was doing an elder hostel about 3-4 years ago on the general subject, whatever happened to that old-time religion, which I'm going to be doing here next week, and I had a wonderful person named Bill, I forget his last name, he was from North Carolina, rural North Carolina. He was a born-again evangelical Methodist from rural North Carolina. He knew the whole thing. I've done a lot on fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and we had a grand time talking. Jesus Christ was his personal Lord and Savior. He was born again. He was washed in the blood of the Lamb. He accepted the full authority of the Scriptures. The whole thing, absolutely nothing. He was very comfortable. He gave a witness, a testimony. We shared, we prayed together, we did the whole thing. And then I was talking, and the next day, and I talked about this fellow from India, down in San Diego, Deepak Chopra. And he just lit up. Deepak Chopra, that's a guy I read all the time. I don't know where I'd be without Deepak Chopra. And Chopra comes, some of you might know Chopra, he comes from an entirely different perspective than what we would call Western Christianity, the Ayurvedic kind of a tradition altogether. But Bill had no trouble, that's my point, Bill had no trouble putting these two, his North Carolina Evangelical Methodist perspective and his Deepak Chopra thing together, and it gave him a great deal of sustenance and help. A second one, I was doing an adult forum down at this was King of Glory in Tempe, and you get to know the people after 2 or 3 times, and you talk and everything, and there was this one woman who was Wisconsin Synod, and she, from Snowbird, from Milwaukee, and she came to this church because that's where her children went, she wanted to go there, and she didn't go there, that's why a Wisconsin Synod member went to a ELC church, that's what I'm trying to say. And we got talking, and as it turned out, the faith healer, Benny Hinn, was in town that week, And some of you know Benny Hinn from Trinity Broadcast Network and Santa Ana and all these things. And this is the old classic stand-up, you know, Oral Roberts kind of heel. Only he has a blow-dry sort of thing and interesting neckties and so on. But he's very, very, very effective. And we got talking about faith healers and Pentecostals and all the rest. And she said, well, you know, I want to go down and I want to be healed by Benny Hinn and I want to be slain in the spirit. And I about, you know, dropped whatever. A Wisconsin Synod person wants to be slain in the spirit. This is the old Pentecostal thing where you go up and he lays his hands on you and you swoon and you faint back and two big football tackles catch you. And if you ever see that in a Wisconsin Synod church, call me. Call me. call me Colette. And I want to know how that. And she was very, I have to say, she knew her theology. She knew her catechism. This is most certainly true. The whole thing. She knew it cold. And she had no trouble making this kind of bridge between her Wisconsin Synod orthodoxy and Benny Hinn. No problem. I begin to think, Erling, something's going on here that you don't really understand, along with Bill. And the third one was a combined adult forum program up in Burnsville, which is a suburb of South Minneapolis. Very strong for new churches and Prince of Peace Lutheran, and is probably the best known one out here for all these things. And they had the Episcopalians, the Catholics, the Lutherans, and the Presbyterians had a four-part series, joint series. You're going to bring people together for an adult forum series. And it wasn't a Bible study, it wasn't church history, it wasn't ethics. It was tactility, massage, meditation, and acupuncture. This is in a mainline tradition, Catholic, Episcopalian, Lutheran, Presbyterian. They're doing acupuncture, tactility, massage, and the other one. I thought something is going on here, and what's happening, and this is my argument, and this is what I'm working on, is that there is a redefinition of what we mean by religious faith taking place, a very strong redefinition that hasn't ended yet. The old-time religion, the one that I talk about in the other series here, simply has virtually disappeared. The old-time religion where basically the idea was that you define what religious faith is through the orthodox, you know, standard teachings of the church. The church is the agency which defines us. In sociological terms, and I'm oversimplifying here, but it's the only way I can get at it, sociological terms, this is religion from the top down rather than religion from the bottom up. A religion from the top down is a religion that comes out of the seminaries and the well-educated clergy. And the great faith and the great cathedrals and the great art that we have and our Beethoven and Bach and music, for instance, in our particular tradition. And the same is true with the Gregorians and all the rest and the Catholics. That that's religion from the top down. And what there's clearly a groundswell in today, and it's happening all over, sometimes this is called downsizing, just the general sociological thing, is religion from the bottom up. What you and I were talking about today, Warren, about the church is in trouble. And I've heard people at the seminary say, if the horse is dead, it's time to dismount. get on. If any of you know Pat Kiefer up at Luther Seminary, this is his new punchline. But anyway, it's a good one. So there's something going on here. And what I'm saying is that these neat categories that we used to have about healing and about orthodoxy, about doctrine, all these things simply are disappearing. And what I find is exciting and oftentimes much more frustrating movement where the older worlds of orthodox faith and orthodox medicine are breaking down in this world that we live in today of suspicion of authority and what we call the postmodernist temper, deconstruction kind of stuff, and a much greater interest in what I suppose you could call grassroots kinds of things, from the bottom up rather than from the top down. And I think my own personal feeling, just to get that settled before we go, some of this is good, some of this isn't so good, because we have some areas which are very much in need of definition and some areas which I think are very much, very, very clearly established. So let's turn for some definitions here then to the first one. The best one, the way to put it, is what I call CAM, or Complementary Alternative Medicine. CAM is simply the acronym for this, and what I have on the board here is just the word complimentary, not a compliment if you're wearing a nice suit or tie or something else, that's one kind of compliment, but complimentary means something else, and alternative means something else. All right, what's happened, and this is nothing brand new, we've had complimentary and alternative medicine ever since, the Greeks, and going way back to and the Romans, as far as we know in Western culture. But what's happened is that there is much greater interest in this in our particular day and age. And just to use to use my notes here, alternative medicine is, this is the important one, alternative medicine is any medical system based on a theory of disease or its treatment, any system based on a theory of disease or treatment that is incompatible with orthodox science of medicine. That's the point, it's incompatible with the orthodox science of medicine, allopathy, as it is practiced in the accredited medical schools. Sometimes, just for jargon, this is called AMA medicine or pill and scalpel medicine. I think that's the point, because there are something like 161 accredited medical schools in the country, and they have various standards, and everybody, in order to practice medicine to get their license, has to practice that. And that, for a long time, has been what we would call orthodox medicine, traditional medicine, whatever you want to call it, AMA, pill and scalpel kind of medicine. All right. That's one kind, and if you want definitions, if you want things, I was pleased to see that the library here has, one of the huge numbers of books on alternative medicine. This is the Goldberg group, and this is, I'm going to leave it over in the library afterwards if you want to browse through here. Because when we say that it's not orthodox or traditional kind of medicine, that means, really, what is it? And it can mean just about anything that isn't AMA or pill and scalpel, kind of medicine. And the ones that are that we'll be talking, I'll be talking mostly about visualization and therapeutic touch and meditation. But just to give you some indication of the scope here, this is from eight of, it goes from acupuncture to yoga. I think that's sound therapy, osteopathy, all sorts of things. Mind-body, I'm going to talk a good deal about that because that's really where the action is right now. Energy medicine, fasting, the polite one is called colon therapy. I remember where I got first interested in this, I was at a Muni conference in Korea, and a person was giving me a pitch for high colonic therapy, and I wanted to know what that meant, and some of you are smiling already, what that really means is a daily enema. And I wasn't quite ready for that, coming from my particular position. I thought only when we got in trouble or something was didn't need something like that. But aromatherapy, acupuncture, biofeedback, enormous variety of things here. But I want to, and some of these are pure out and out hokum quackery, off the wall snake oil medicine. And some of them I think are very serious. And for instance, in Scottsdale, there's one series right down on Stetson, right by the big IMAX theater there. It has a very responsible kind of program. They're doing a lot of good things. I spend time with them and working with us. The other part of the CAM thing is complementary medicine, and that simply means supplemental medicine. An increasing number of MDs are using some of the things, and I'm going to give a couple of examples here, of complementary medicine to go along with orthodox kind of medicine. You do your usual thing, but then you do some other things too. I heard somebody talk, I mentioned Bernie Siegel. He is a surgeon. I think he's retired basically altogether now. He used to write a lot of things, but he did the oncological surgery at Yale Medical School. But he did a lot of other things along with it, not just the traditional sort of hard science kind of method of medicine. But he did a lot of other things with visualization and guided imagery and meditation and aromatherapy and things that are coming along with this. I know myself, I'm just fascinated by this one very small, but to me, a very helpful sort of supplement. For a long time, he didn't come all this way to hear me talk about my physical problems, but I have to give one here. I've had prostatitis for years and years, and you learn to live with it. What I like is a urologist soon have learned to accept the fact that these guys know more about this than they do, because you've seen it come up and go. So anyway, I tried with my family doctor to do this and that, and antibiotics and all the rest of things, and they didn't get anywhere, and they tried some anti-inflammation thing, and that didn't get anywhere. And so finally, the urologist, just 2 weeks before I came, put me on something that's straight off, straight over the counter. It's called Saw Paletto. And it works. I'm just amazed it's herbs. But he was like Dr. Farber. He was open enough to try something new. That's what I'm excited about. And if it works, it works. I mean, that's this sort of thing. And I'm not here to sell Saw Paletto. I mean, there's no place you have to sign up, or I don't have a little concession or something else like that. But so far, so good. And let me give you a couple other examples of this. What's taking place? I'll read here because I want to be sure this is right. Here is the Complementary Care Center at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York. Some of you know, right up there by George Washington Bridge. Three rooms adjacent to the cardiac unit offer individual sessions in visualization, hypnosis, meditation, yoga, massage, and therapeutic touch. This is one of the six big hospitals, you know, in the New York area. As a part of the preparation for a triple bypass, a typical patient spends a week listening to audio tapes with relaxing instructions in a custom tailored hypnosis session, which is taking place. More evidence about this, I had it later on, but it fits in here just as well. Of the 161 accredited medical schools, over half now offer at least one course in complementary medicine. Not necessarily in alternative medicine, but at least in alternative medicine. I was very impressed. I couldn't get in. This summer, I live in southeast Minnesota, and I noticed for the Elder Hostel at Mayo Clinic, one of the subjects was complementary medicine. And even for Mayo to admit that they should talk about it is a major breakthrough for a lot of these people, because some of them wrap themselves, and I don't mean to be sarcastic, but they wrap themselves in the mantle of hard science. And if it isn't in the lab, if it isn't proven in the laboratory, sure.
I was just going to say, I've spent more time than I'd like in the past couple of years in trauma wards and oncology, and that's where I found out about therapeutic touch. And this is a major hospital, Harvard used the Northwest Center, Regional Center for Trauma, and also Tacoma General, and they both had staff training in therapeutic touch.
Others? Examples of something that
I just have another comment.
Sure.
In terms of hard science, in terms of the general practice of medicine, very little of it is hard science. I mean that's the truth. You know, it is. And so to create this illusion that the AMA medicine is all hard science and this other isn't, whether good or that is in itself a false.
Come Saturday, I'm going to talk about that. There's a science writer up at McMaster University in Canada, David Kinsley, and he's got a book out, Health, Science, and Healing, and this is exactly his point, that hard science, as we understand it, Western science, is very much culture-bound, and it's individualistic rather than collective, all sorts of things that go along with this, and it's not necessarily this. And then, thank you for that. That's very helpful, but I want to talk about this on Saturday. So. And then it's a part of this idea of, you know, not showing as much respect, so to speak, for older traditional authorities as has been the case before, just as in the case in churches. Okay. So with that in mind, let's turn to sort of the other stream. I think there are two streams here. One would be the new stream of complementary alternative medicine that's moving in a certain direction. And otherwise also, I think there's another stream clearly where what we would call mainline Protestant and Catholic interest here is moving towards a much wider, broader, and I think myself personally, deeper understanding of this whole business about the relationship between our physical health and our healing. That they can't sort of separate these out into sort of two separate categories, and where the doctor comes in and does what the doctor can do, and when that's no good, then the minister comes in, or the chaplain comes in and sort of takes over and mops up after that, and that I think is clearly on the way. For instance, if you take the word healing and you look at it in either the Hebrew or the Greek, healing is the same thing as salvation, as to be, you know, to be saved. Clearly, the emphasis is always on wholeness and being at one with the way in which God, or Yahweh, if you like, created us. The word salvation comes from the root word salva, which means something that is to be healed and to be made whole. To be saved is to be made whole, just to repeat that again. Both the Hebrew and Christian faith have their foundings, the idea of healing being essentially religious, you know, in its nature. That this is, you can't sort of separate these things out into different categories. That really came from the French philosopher, some of you know, René Descartes, back in the 1700s, where he separated out everything into mind or body. And the mind, you know, kept them apart for a long time. That was very handy, and it was like my neat little categories that I had to build when my Wisconsin sin and friends sort of shattered for me, that these little neat categories simply don't work any longer. Okay, with that in mind, let's look at a couple of specific forms of CAM kind of medicine. So some of you might still listen to Paul Harvey, and that Paul Harvey would say at this point, and now for page two on this. And he's another Phoenician that doesn't need the money, but he certainly keeps on. About 90 years old, isn't there something? Just keeps on going. Where does he get those stories?
He just did research.
He's to the right of Genghis Khan in his politics, but he tells good stories. I'll say that for him. Okay. generally, and here's where I get into the sort of academic categorization thing, but it's necessary on this point. There are sort of four basic groups within the complementary alternative medicine things, these four kinds of practices. First would be what we would call the spiritual and the psychological kinds of categories of complementary alternative medicine. This would include psychics, this would include mystics, people who do, you know, paranormal kind of healings. And there are also people who get involved in things a little bit more down to earth, I think, in things like hypnosis or things like laughter therapy. And on Wednesday, I'm going to talk about the most famous case of all, of course, and that would be Norman Cousins with laughter therapy that works so well, but that's something I'll save for then. A second group would be the nutritional herbology and vitamin mineral people who feel this is the way to go, as my doctor did with this thing called Saul Palermo. A third group would be the drugs in the biological categories. They use drugs, they use chemicals, vaccines, treatments to enhance the immune system. This is a clearly defined sort of practice in medicine. And fourth would be the physical treatment with physical forces and devices. Chiropractors, massage, acupuncture, things like this. So you've got sort of four kinds of CAM medicine here. I'd call them the spiritual, the nutritional, the drugs, if you like, and the physical. And the point here is clear, and this would be the thing that I'm driving at here, and this is, there's a very good book called Nature's Prozac, and the author says this: call it meditation, self-hypnosis, behavior modification, or introspection. Call it any of these things. Meditation, self-hypnosis, behavior modification, introspection. It is at this subconscious level, that's the point, I've got that underlined, it is at the subconscious level that the body works to get well. That's, it's sometimes, in a broad sense, this is mind-body medicine, but this is a whole new thing. There's one author who says that the mind, or the brain, the way he puts it, the brain is, to use the British word, an apothecary, or a place where there are all sorts of ways and means of healing ourselves that we haven't even touched yet. John, you and I are talking a little about this, and my own personal feeling is that we're right on the verge of a real breakthrough on some of these things. Just now begin to find some of these things that are working. It's not to say that things like the placebo effect and all these haven't been known for a long time, obviously, and we'll be talking about placebo, that they have worked, but I think they're beginning to find these things. And what I'm trying to suggest is that places like Columbia Presbyterian in New York and all the rest are more open to this than have been the case before. That seems to be fairly clear. It is at this subconscious level that the body works to get well. Chinese and Indian methods have mastered this approach, and that's why I want to talk on Wednesday about drawing from the Chinese and from the Indian, like people like Deepak Chopra, on these things. Okay, now here to sort of pinpoint the issue. This sort of new trend conflicts directly, with allopathic science, which has wrapped itself in the mantle of hard science. Alternative complementary medicine is still on the fringe, in many places, because it lacks the mantle of hard science. The hard science people are saying that if you ignore hard science, you are not using all the tools available for effecting long-range healing. You're not using all the tools that are available. The CAM people think that the mantle of hard science pretty much has seen its day, and they're moving in new directions, and I want to give a couple of examples of how this is taking place. All right. Now, that's the one stream of things that are moving, more towards an alternative explanation, which is really, I think, right on the fringe. The other would be what the Christian faith brings to this whole field of healing. Because from the very beginning, and I'll talk about this tomorrow, one of the things that obviously was at the very center of Jesus' ministry was healing. And we had the healing text yesterday. The woman with the 18 years with her problem, and obviously the instant healing that took place there. And what I think is the case now is that within, in a broad sense of the word here, the Christian tradition, we have sort of four categories of how Christians go about this problem, or not the problem, or the command, the mandate, if you like, to do healing. First, there is the clinical psychological tradition. Using secular wisdom as well as insights, in the Bible for healing. This is basically healing by counseling, which is familiar and for many people, maybe even here, has been very helpful. I know myself, I was going to, these good friends here know who I'm talking about, with Emily White, who was a longtime friend of Holden and helped me enormously. And one day where I was very upset about something, and we're up on the top tailings, and she all remembers this, and I was really upset about things, and I had somehow to release my anger, And so she had me throwing stones off the tailing. I went around afterwards feeling pretty good. Take that, Dale. The Dale was the enemy in this in this case, and I got it out of my system. But she had very strong faith and was able to blend these two together. The second, besides the counseling one, would be the evangelical approach, and that would be primarily to recognize when there's evil, suffering, pain, disease, all these things in the world. It's basically the work of Satan. That and in order to engage and to heal, one has to accept the fact that there is sort of a basic satanic dimension to these things, and health is a matter of restoring, restoring your health by doing combat right with Satan. In many ways, a very controversial idea, but one which many people take very seriously, and that's basically the whole idea that you find in people like Benny Hill. This was funny. I have to mention that because there's a sideline here. Somebody misunderstood me once, and I said I was talking about Benny Hinn, and she thought I was talking about Benny Hill. And she said, I turned on Benny Hill on the TV. And she said, I laughed a lot, but I didn't find anything about healing. And if you know, Benny Hill has a wonderful film. He's a gift, absolutely a gift. Okay. The third would be the sacramental or the liturgical approach. We have direct access to healing here through use of the sacraments, especially the Eucharist. This is enhanced by healing services, such as we have at Holden here, where scripture is read, prayers are said, they're singing, they're laying on of hands. It sounds like James 5, that's what it is. And the fourth would be the Pentecostal charismatic way of healing, the use of the spiritual gifts, especially from 1 Corinthians 12, where healing is a specific gift given to people. Okay. Now, what I'm arguing here is that these two streams, the medical stream and the religious stream, have been apart for a long time, but for reasons which I'm trying to work out and develop, and I'm shamelessly asking you, for your ideas on this. I'm field testing is what I'm doing, and brain picking here, and I'd be delighted to get your ideas here. I've learned a lot of things from some of the audiences that I've done before. They're talking to each other, they're listening to each other, and they're being more open to each other than is the case before. And I give you as my personal examples would be my evangelical friend Bill, and my Wisconsin Synod friend, who wants to have wants to be slain in the spirit. Now, what is new here is that there is so much more great widespread public interest in this than has ever been the case before. There have always been these traditions. You can go back and you can find these things. But clearly, starting in the early 1990s, and since I'm a historian, I think in chronological terms here, starting in the 1990s, and I want to just very quickly summarize the evidence here, you find an enormous number of people getting interested in these things and getting involved, not just reading, but going to seminars and programs. I've got a tape, for instance, of here's somehow things are new. Would you believe Harvard Divinity School and Harvard Medical School together sponsored a seminar on the new healing? When you can get Harvard Medical School and Harvard Divinity School together on anything. What was it Robert Hutchins once said about the only thing that held the University of Chicago together was the plumbing system? And I think that would be true for Harvard Medical School and Harvard Divinity School. They're talking seriously about these issues.
It seems that both myself and for involvement of the people that I know, they get interested in these when they're confronted with either their own illness, an illness of someone they love that's not curable, or the medical community can't deal with.
Yep.
For myself, my son has ADHD, and the traditional medical approach is just to give the medicine, although there's others that are enlightened. But there's been some of my friends who had great success dealing with someone who was talking about sensory integration disorder, which a lot of the medical community isn't even familiar with, where the little bald boy didn't get enough nerve input from his system, and they were brushing him with like a brush, and he'd light up. He'd just be as happy as a clam. But the medical community completely dismisses it.
Yeah, that's basically a nice way of putting the problem, the issue here. For one thing, besides nurse practitioners, do we have MDs here? Like those? Yeah. I'd be interested in your comments as we go along. I have to tell one story. I'm aware of this. I had this sort of rejoinder coming to me. I was talking and I said, compared to an MD, when a historian or a writer makes a mistake, it's there for everybody to see. But when an MD makes a mistake, you can bury it. And this doctor was not amused, not at all. He sort of waited for me when I was going to slip up on something. And then about 15, 20 minutes later, he sent me a zinger that I had coming. I recognized this, and my good friend, who was sort of listening in on me, said, Erling, you had that one coming too. Absolutely. But there, in my first book, there was a mistake, and there it was, and it can never be corrected. So anyway, so a hand here.
At the beginning you were talking about that in our religions, it's sort of a grassroots, and people are asking for a redefining of our of our faith and how our faith and our healing, or that's the way I understood you anyways, that it's sort of a grassroots, and people are asking. And it seems like that coincides with what's happening in medicine, too. People are asking, and it's a grassroots type thing from what I see of people saying, what else is there, and what, you know, and so when you say that's on you, you know, can you imagine these two medical groups coming together? I'm sure there's other reasons too, but I think some of it is because they are responding to people's questions.
Yep.
About these things.
I have a neighbor in the English department, Joan Hepburn, and she's slowly losing her sight. She's getting the best treatment and everything, and she's doing the traditional Orthodox kind of thing, and she's doing all the complementary thing. And she finds her physicians are very helpful and supportive of what she's trying to do with this, and that's what she has sort of to hold on to. And she's not gullible, or this isn't any kind of snake oil, as I say, medicine man kind of show or anything else like this. Very responsible kind of stuff.
Just to give you input, I'm not a nurse practitioner or a doctor. I'm an engineer.
Engineer.
And this is, I'm still using the scientific process, but there's few hard facts in the world.
I've even heard that sometimes when you're watching an experiment happen, just watching it somehow makes a difference.
Yeah.
There's some stuff that gets me all nervous about what was taking place. Anyway, back to the manuscript here. No. What's happening, I think, are some of these are coming together. All right. Now, the next question, and since Susan said I would explain why I think this is happening, I have sort of, from a medical standpoint, I think I have sort of a negative and a positive explanation of why these things are happening. And we've covered these briefly here, and this is so familiar, I don't want to spend too much time with it. But from a negative standpoint, and some of these things are things that we're all familiar with, there is the idea of looking for something besides all the, the impersonality, the bureaucracy, the high costs, the red tape, all this, and people are looking for, something else on that. I like to use Holden examples. I met a fellow here, remarkable, 1975, Paul Fanning. He was a businessman in Minnesota. He's retired, and he loved to come out here. We would share, and we would witness and sing hymns together and do all sorts of things. And Paul told us, did you know Paul back there? Sure, you were wonderful guy, sure. Right. And anyway, Paul was a man of very strong faith, and he retired and went to Santa Barbara, and started going to see his physician, and soon he learned what they were practicing is what Paul called pat and push medicine. They patted him on the head and they pushed him out the door. And Paul was not happy with pat and push medicine. He wasn't, so what he did on his own, he got up and flew out to Rochester and got on a whole different radical kind of program. And he said, Erling, they gave me 2 more years. But he wasn't ready to accept the fact that he was, sent off to the rocking chair. If you remember Paul, he was fairly outspoken, he might say. Understatement, right. He would rewrite hymns if he didn't like them, and he would rewrite Bible verses. And a wonderful guy, absolutely. But anyway, that's the point. All right. There's a growing impatience with the AMA's, greatest strengths, and that would be specialization. Nothing like specialization. We all give stories here of people who have been helped enormously. I like to tell the story about my brother, because we live just 50 miles from Rochester, and he's had 5 major surgical procedures at Mayo. Just drive down there, and his wife had had cancer for 8 years and battled that out, and he now can carry on a very normal life, lasers for his eyes and all these things. And the way Oscar came to terms with all this was keeping up his sense of humor. He worked for State Farm, so he knows all about claims and payments and all these things. So after the last one, this just happened this summer, the last one, Oscar walked in to settle up with a business office, and he looked at him and he said, look at my record, look at my wife's record. And he said, how about a discount? Which is a word you don't hear in Rochester very often. And they picked up on his sense of humor, because that's really the thing that kept Oscar going. They said, no, we can't give you a discount, but we can give you free parking. He does have free parking. They put out the little orange pylon when Oscar comes, right? At the Kaler parking lot that some of you might know there, and they kept the thing going. So all sorts of things. Okay, but rising impatience with specialization, more people want, you know, wholeness, integrative sort of things. And of course, MDs can come right back and say, that's fine, we would like it too, but how about those 15 patients, you know, who are sitting, you know, out in the waiting room for me, and it's 5 o'clock and I can't get home until I see those, and we just don't have enough time, you know, for all of this sort of thing. Okay. And then I think there's one thing that can be said in terms of advertising and AMA, and especially the pharmaceutical companies. Oftentimes, I think the pharmaceutical companies oversell, you know, their effectiveness. If I can use this expression, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we, you know, do this or that sort of thing? And oftentimes, now when is it true? The MDs can help me with this. That now in the last few years, companies advertise pharmaceuticals as sort of an end run around the HMOs, so that the patients will know that there's another alternative to what the HMOs will allow for a prescription. Because all of a sudden, I see these advertising things in Time and Newsweek and everything else, and then there's one thing I've never seen that before.
Well, it wasn't on their formulary. And so consequently, they advertise to the general public to get it on their formulary. Yeah,
right. And then it's a good thing not to read those things, because I look at the possible side effects. You know, and if all those are true, you never take anything except maybe lentil meatloaf or something.
That one, that's better.
Anyway, the growing dissatisfaction, suspicion of the supremacy of hard science medicine. I think that's true, and I want to talk about that on Saturday. And then on the other hand, there's the positive side, that many of the schools that I've mentioned are open to some of these things, and some of the responsible people have become, you know, bestsellers. I just rattle off a few of the names here. I've already mentioned, Bernie Siegel. Chopak, I mentioned. Herbert Benson, I want to talk about him, especially on Wednesday with meditation. He's a Harvard heart doctor who's done an enormous amount of good things with meditation. Andrew Weil, for some of you from the Southwest, talk about him. He's very, very class. Sells. I thought one day he was going to do some autographing at the Borders Bookstore in Phoenix. I thought I'd drop down and talk, have a little chat with Andrew. I soon realized there wasn't any parking within the Borders down there in Camelback within about 2 miles, because he's just a huge success and with these things. Joan Borisenko, talk about Dolores Krieger, she's the one with Therapeutic Touch. Jeannie Ochterberg in visualization. These people are bestsellers, and there is an enormous interest in weekend seminars that are taking place around the country. You can find these people doing all sorts of things now. There is a major source of money for this. It's called the John Templeton Foundation. I don't know if some of you know this one. It was very sustained and I think responsible financing of many types of new research that hasn't been able to attract funding before. John Templeton, and especially the larger field, is science and religion. And he's been, it's a sort of a thing like it's a brand label. If you know it's being sponsored by John Templeton, you know that it's responsible. Because again, there are all kinds of quacks and rip-off artists for this sort of thing. And a lot of interest in through magazines and all these things. And then the one that sort of is, yes, it's good, and no, it isn't. I've been talking to somebody. Alternative medicine is on the internet. And as I say, that's, to me, one step forward and 10 steps back. Because I thought I had, I know you're not interested in my definition of how I frame the problem for the rebranding, but I get a hold of something, I get all excited, and I push, enter, and I get on the next World Wide Web, and then 10 new things happen that I didn't know were there, or 10 new sources, and then that multiplies into 100. And it's just staggering, the amount of information that's there. And it's my job, obviously, as a researcher, to sort these things out. But alternative medicine is on the net, and people, in a way that's helping, because people are getting information about some of these things that they wouldn't have been able to get before. And some of these are responsible, and some of these are off the wall. I mean, I don't know if some of you, I can give some addresses if you want to get these things yourself, but some of the strange things that you find there, I sort of got used to strange things in theology, but on the net, but this is really weird sort of stuff. So what I'm trying to suggest here, and then we'll have time for discussion, is that we've got the two streams taking place. The one, alternative medicine, with many sort of limitations and shortcomings and all the rest, making some, I think, very responsible moves and helpful moves in one direction, and then the organized religious community, making some moves, in another. Okay. Now, I think we have to talk a little bit about why should the churches be widening and broadening their definition, you know, of religious faith and being open to the sort of things that we're talking about here. For one thing, and one thing that's very clear, is that I've suggested that in the 40s and in the 50s, when we talked about religious faith, what we really meant was what the church said religious faith was all about. When I grew up, and I, you know, I'd be glad to talk about Garrison Keillor and Lake Obegon and everything, because he must have grown up in my hometown. He grew up in Anoka, Minnesota. But I grew up, I have to tell some people, some of you have heard this, but I grew up in Kenyon, Minnesota. There are 8 Norwegian Lutheran churches within 10 miles. That's cultural homogeneity. That's what that is. And they're still all going, and they're still all one-point pastors. So I grew up, you know, with a catechism that we bought at Acres Grocery and memorized the catechism, and everything that I thought about religion was compressed, you know, into what the church taught. And the same thing is true. You read this with Catholics and so many others. This is the 39 articles, if you like, with the Anglicans and the Westminster Confession with Presbyterians. And that basically was it. But for all sorts of reasons, what's happening is that we are now in what one of the writers I just recently read, we are now in what we call mix and match religion. I think this is a good term for this. And this would be what my evangelical friend Bill practices. Mix and match. You take some from here, you take some from there. We, you know, in my little hometown, we didn't even talk to the Catholics, for instance. And I've just been reading K. Garrison Keillor now. We didn't buy from the Catholic grocer, the Flick brothers, you know. And we didn't even the Lutherans divided. I wanted to date Patty Deardahl, but she was Haugie Lutheran. And she said she liked me, but she said I wasn't Haugie Lutheran, so I wasn't going to heaven. And that took care of my choice with Patty Deardahl. But she married another nice boy, Donnie Byrne. He was a Haugie Lutheran. And they had 6 kids, so that's fine. Okay. There's clearly a move away from believing that what the traditional Orthodox creeds, catechisms, and all the rest of the church, you know, encompasses all of religion itself. That's much more from the bottom up rather than from the top down. And if this isn't so much true in the Lutheran Church, for instance, or the Episcopalian, and I think the thing that holds us to the older tradition there, and I would give up on the faith, I think, if this was ever changed, because there's always talk about changing seminaries and everything. But the thing I think that holds it together is having a well-educated clergy. I think that's the crux here for keeping the mainstream and the mainline churches, you know, where they are. Because I was just reading a thing today that what we have to do is let congregations decide what courses the seminary, I mean, what courses their pastor should have at seminary. I thought this was a bit much. Because all sorts of things. But anyway, the second thing that I think has opened the button, and I've already suggested this, is the whole move towards much more great interest in Asian religions, especially Chinese and Indian. A very good book came out of this and really got my interest going on this was Bill Moyer's book, Healing in the Mind, and it came out on PBS about 3 years ago. And what Moyer, of course, he himself is a Southern Baptist clergy and knows, you know, the media very well. He was LBJ's press secretary and all these things. And what Moyer did was go around and interview these people who are interested in this, and Borisenko and all these, and Benson, and get some ideas. And then he found a Harvard-trained MD who was also fluent in Chinese, a very rare combination. But he found them, and they went over and they studied Chinese medicine from the standpoint of Western medicine, because here he was trained in one of the best medical schools in the country. And they talked about this back and forth, and opened up things here which hadn't really been known before. And just as a sort of a humorous aside, one of my favorite television shows is MASH, and there was this wonderful thing where Dr. Winchester, Harvard MD, right, is trained and he's got a terrible toothache, and they can't do anything for him. They bring in an old Korean medicine man with all his herbs and different things and chants and whistles and bells and all the rest of these things that go along with this. And Winchester, the MD from Harvard, had to admit that that's what cured his condition. It was a television thing. It's not scientific, but it sort of made the point. Okay. And there's much greater openness, I think, to things like experimentation in liturgy and education, all these things that are taking place now. And so what I'm finding is that in the churches, people are more open to ways, the only way to put it in theological terms is this, people are more open to ways in which God is working through, in this case, the medical world, or the scientific community, if you like, in the broadest sense of the word, than they had been before. Because we had taken a very dim view, for instance, of things which are Asian, especially from China or India or something else like that. And there are still some who argue this, and I want to talk about this when I talk about the critics, because we have some people Paul Reiser, he's an MD, he writes for InterVarsity Press, has a book called New Age Healing. And he says, is once you get going in this stuff, like Deepak Chopra and all the rest, what you're really doing is leading, you know, born on the path into New Age voodoo kind of stuff. And other people are saying that no, what we are finding is God is at work in ways which we simply didn't know before. And that if God can work through, you know, a way which was considered to be, you know, non-Christian before, then who are we to sort of stand in judgment of this? And so all sorts of things that are going on. And then that's what I want to sort of tomorrow review the Christian position on this. I've got a handout on listing all the healing miracles of Jesus, and then whatever happened to healing in the Christian churches, because for a long time, healing disappeared in the Christian churches, and it wasn't until the Pentecostals brought it back. 1906, at the famous Azusa Street Revival, when they started speaking in tongues and healing, that it came back. And now suddenly, you know, you can't wait, like Mark Pearson's book here talks about this. So that's what I want to talk about. Your comments, questions?
Well, you didn't say anything about the Christian scientists.
Christian science, yep, comes up, right. That, I should mention that. Thank you for that. Christian science is a whole different ballgame. And I, there are some things that you can't put in, you know, just space limitations, and editors don't like you to try to cover everything. Like I'd love to write it. I could write, you know, anybody could write a book this big, and wouldn't that be fun? Except for the people who have to read it. You know, like my wife and my children, and so on. But anyway, Christian science is not in this because well, Mary Baker Eddy denies the existence, you know, of evil. That's the only way to put it. Or anything which doesn't, or the existence of matter itself. Anything that is sort of wrong or corrupting or evil or sinful or disease-producing in all these countries is simply a matter of the figment of, is a figment of the imagination, and that you can will it away. And I argue that that's a tradition we've got. If you want to learn about Mary Baker Eddy, we've got lots of good biographies. I can give you lists of her biographers and everything else, but it just simply isn't within this thing. I'm not going to change the subject from this, but I'm not doing Native American spirituality in this either, although that's a hot topic in many cases now with Black Elk and all sorts of other things. But there are some things you just can't put in there, right?
Yeah, there was an old theologian that once said that, and with respect to Christian science, it's like grape nuts. Neither grapes nor nuts.
I have to think about that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, the best example there would be, I'm sure you all have your stories, but we had in one in Minneapolis a few years ago where there was a boy about 12, and he had a bowel obstruction, and parents were Christian science, and they refused to bring in, you know, medical personnel, and he died. And the state quite rightly sued. Absolutely, the first purpose of any government is to protect life. If that can be from foreign invaders, it can be from someone else, and they sued and they won over this. They argued freedom of religion kind of thing, and we can do anything, but no, the state has to protect life, and that's what I'm arguing. And with Christian science, it's not mind over matter kind of thing. It's a way which you, well, I don't want to sort of over psychologize on this, but she had some sort of miraculous healing herself, Mrs. Eddy, and was so sort of overwhelmed by this that, in fact, many of the great healers have had this too. Oral Roberts would be a good example. He had very serious asthmatic conditions when he was a boy, and almost died when he was 17. And there was a healing, and he spent the rest of his life saying thank you to God for the healing. And that's why he got involved in this. And Catherine Kuhlman had the same thing. She was what she called miraculously healed. And these people, I don't know if Benny Hinn has or not. I don't say that sarcastically. I just don't know.
He stuttered.
But he's what?
He stuttered and was extremely low self-esteem.
He doesn't stutter anymore, that's for sure. He's very, what's the word, loquacious, I think. It just keeps coming out and so on. But I think that would be my response to, you know, to that. Sure. John. You want to tell us about your friend?
I enjoyed the word loquacious.
Loquacious, okay. It's complicated enough so that most people don't really know what it means. And it sounds profound, but it really isn't, right?
One of the John has a thing that's interesting, and just I'll tell you about my friend later, but I read this book just recently, Fire in the Soul.
Yes.
About a Jewish woman psychologist who was a wonderful book. Confirming or at least some of the stuff that I also think about, and she quoted a lot of Christian mystics, and I was really enjoying the book, but this is just one of the things that you might be confronted with, and suddenly she has one chapter, delicately written about past lives.
Mm.
And I kind of just, she said, well, you can believe it or not. I don't know. I can't believe it.
Whatever. Isn't that the word of the 1990s? Whatever.
Yeah. But then she went on and did other stuff that was really good in it. But that's what happens when you read some of this.
Yep.
You go along and along and you're feeling good. And then suddenly it's really out of your Wisconsin-centered book of practice. Yeah. And you're hard to put it together.
Right. Interesting. He has a friend that has some ideas going that I found very interesting.
I'll talk about it later.
I was hoping you'd talk about it now, so if you could.
Well, if you want me to, but you do want me to.
Yeah, I do. You're a trained public speaker, so.
Well, I absolutely speak. My wife works for a psychologist, and I've worked with the psychologist. Well, he has, in the last year, he's a person that spends a lot of money, a lot of time finding and working in new areas of psychology. Had a lot of extra stuff on his PhD. And he has a thing that he's gained from a guy named Richard Callahan, called thought-filled therapy. And thought-filled therapy is about, I would call it a verbal acupuncture of sorts. And it involves the use of tapping on parts of your body in a certain sequence. And those areas of tapping are equivalent to the areas of the meridians of acupuncture. And for some people, not all people, but for some people, they are able to be healed of some phobias, some fears, and some pain. I say it doesn't work for everybody because I know someone that doesn't work for it. But for others, it has reduced their pain, their phobias, and then. Another aspect of it is called voice technology. It's another level. And voice technology is where you speak into this machine, and the machine is able to tell things that probably your subconscious is saying, or about perhaps allergies, for example. You might say the word cauliflower or milk or cheese, and the machine would give some sort of report to Steve and tell that person that he or she has an allergy to that particular thing. Or it helps him to define that, what he calls a logarithm, the formula of the tapping, because you don't just do it many different patterns. My wife works for him, and she has a lot of people coming in and going out, and a lot of people are reducing their pain and their fears in one or two sessions. And he's a person who believes that it's unethical for him to hold back a therapy to someone. And so he oftentimes offers it, and if it doesn't work, he goes into the standard therapy, which he's one of the best. Mm-hmm. Is that enough?
That's good.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got this thing about driving in the mountains. I can't on the flatlander. And at least I don't put my head between my legs when I go over Wolf Creek Pass in Durango any longer. But my particular one was how I quit smoking. My sister did it by hypnosis. And I did it by electric shock treatment. And I had been smoking on and off for 32 years and had gone to the things, American Heart Association and lung and all these things, and I sat there puffing away, looking at pictures of dissected lungs and all the statistics, and wasn't that nice and everything. And then obviously, what happened was I was trying, this is after my divorce, and I met another woman, I was trying to impress her, and I know she didn't like smoking. So I said, well, let's give it a shot. And this was up at the Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park, a suburb, and they had a system where they told you exactly what it was. 5 days, you went into a little isolation booth like we used to have in those, well, they still have in some quiz shows. And it was aversion therapy, is what it is. And the first thing you got was a terrible smell because they had about 1,000 old smelly cigarette butts there. And you were supposed to not like it. And then there was an MD there, and they put a wrap around your wrist, and every time you took a puff, they gave you a 6-volt shot. And you could stop it at any time. And I had tried everything before. And I just sort of coasted along, and I said, oh, this is kind of fun. Wait till I tell the guys at coffee about this. That went on for 5 days. I could, as I said, quit any time. And then when I settled up financially, they had my brand there, and they said, if you want to light up right now, you don't owe us a cent. They were so sure of it, and I didn't light up. And I figured it took me 13 months to have all that paid for, but cigarettes at that time were 75 cents a pack. And I figured out, you know, how, I mean, the total treatment was $400. So I figured out how long that would take. So in a very real sense, it was free. And then, you know, my lungs say thank you every morning. But then what happened, and this, I want to end on this, is then I developed something that I found in other circles too. I developed all the obnoxious zeal of a convert. And God save us, really, I mean that, from the obnoxious zeal of a convert. Once I was going down to the Hindleys, who got their start here, their restaurant in Pepin, and I was just looking at the view over Lake Pepin, and I was standing there by myself, and a guy popped out of his car and said, "Wait till I tell you about how I've, you know, gotten rid of John Barleycorn." He wanted to testify about alcohol. And I just wanted to look at Lake Pepin. I didn't want to hear about a testimony about John Barleycorn or anything else. But anyway, just to finish, what happened was I came back, and one of my good friends was the dean secretary, Jane. Jane Soley, and we were good friends and everything, and I walked in to the coffee shop, and Jane was puffing away, and I walked right up to her, and I said, "Jane, when I see you smoking, I want to punch you right in the face." She was so mad she didn't talk to me for 2 years. And I had it coming, absolutely, you know, I had it coming. So I don't draw any judgments, and my kids smoke now, and so on. But anyway, it can be done. And then what happened, I took this aversion therapy experience to the psychologist. You mentioned, I thought this was a pretty big deal, and I sort of thought I should get a little more recognition from my counseling friends in the faculty that I was getting. Oh, aversion therapy, early done aversion therapy, isn't that nice? How much did it cost? That was the only thing they were interested in. And I sort of thought, gee whiz, this is a pretty big deal. And so I sort of felt deflated, but I didn't get deflated enough to where I started smoking again. And then what's happened is, maybe some of you know this, I can't find it any longer. People have asked me, you know, where can you find, you know, the electric shock treatment? And I can't find it. It was down in a very, you know, couldn't have been a more respectable place. Medical clinic at the Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. I can't find it. Has anybody heard of it lately?
Never heard of the process, period.
Never, it worked. Boy, did it work.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I can kind of comment on that.
Sure.
It really tells a story on a number of levels. First of all, you look at data, okay, from a scientific standpoint about what works in non-smoking and smoking. Aversion therapy is now on the out in terms of, you know, statistically with groups and people who stay away from cigarettes on a sustained basis. So it's on the out from a scientific, statistical standpoint. But here you're hearing an example, one person,
right,
who that really helped.
Right.
It worked for him.
Right.
But basically how the system works is if you don't have the studies or it doesn't work for the majority, or there are other things that work better,
yeah,
in general.
Yeah.
Okay?
Sure.
Then that's what you have to offer to people.
Places.
And so, but case in point,
yeah, right,
it worked.
Right. The woman who worked with me, the sort of the nurse there, was, she got into it, this is a fabulous thing, because she didn't want her children to know that she was smoking, but she was smoking, and she hid cigarettes in the house, and the kids found the cigarettes. And they suddenly realized mother's been lying to us about smoking. That was enough motivation to get, her name was Tina Bjorken, to get Tina going. And it worked for her. That just drove her right into, you know, into this thing, right? On that happy note, two people who kick smoking, that's Ted Vespers. Okay, thank you.